All right. So this is another class on Zen living.
Yeah.
This idiot's guide that I wrote a number of years ago, about 10 years ago. It's out of print, but you can still get digital copies. Erica and I are trying to find out why that is, but it's not an easy thing. Anyway, we'll have, I misjudged. I think last week I said something about this being the FAQ night, but next week will be. And then that'll be the last class on this book. And then we'll go into another book, which has been announced in the newsletter and is also on the website, which I had mentioned that we were going to do Shinryu Suzuki, the study of the Sando Kai, but I'm going to postpone that because I got excited about this new book called the, I should have it with me, but The Burning House, a Buddhist response to the climate and ecological emergency. And it's funny because not that long ago, I was thinking, you know what, I should, I did one Dharma talk, I think, on Buddhist teachings relevant to the climate and ecological crisis. And I thought, you know, that's what would be really great to just have a, you know, a collection of those. And that's essentially what this guy did. And I think it's very accessible and well-written. So it's about, what I really like about it is there's a lot of references to Buddhist practices and teachings. So many years ago, we did Joanna Macy's Act of Hope, but Act of Hope is not explicitly a Buddhist book. You know, you could see the influences of Buddhism, and she mentions it a couple of times. But this is really explicitly a Buddhist book. And, you know, given this thing, here's some Buddhist teachings and practices that are relevant. So I think it'll be interesting. Whatever your relationship to the climate and ecological emergency, I think what we study will be applicable to many things. But then next week will be the Zen FAQ, where we have, I think I'll find out some way to do a quick vote on which of the questions we should focus on next week. So this week is on a chapter of the book called Zen When Life It Gets Tough. And I'm pleased to see this many people show up because it wasn't announced in the newsletter and it might sound like a depressing topic, but hopefully it's not depressing because either you're going through tough times right now and then you're very interested, or maybe you've gone through tough times in the past and you have something to share, which might be something about how your practice helped you. But then for the rest of us, it can be helpful to think about how practice can continue to support us in tough times which will in it eventually come. Like for all of us, they will come. And my husband often asks me, like, oh, what are you going to be talking about tonight? And I said it, and he said, the gist of it was Zen practice is for when life gets tough. So what are the ways life gets tough? Physical health problems, illness. They can be chronic, ongoing, permanent. Others may not even appreciate what we're going through. Or it may be the physical health and well-being of those we love, those that are close to us. Mental health and well-being, the ours and that of others, including depression, anxiety, loneliness, etc.
Which we discussed last week.
Which we happened to discuss last week. Financial difficulties, relationship challenges, partners, children, parents. I know quite a few folks now caring for aging parents, the challenges of that. Conflicts, dysfunction, watching others suffer. There are work challenges, coworkers, conflicts, stressors, lack of promotion, job loss, unemployment, traumatic experiences, witnessing them or experiencing them, fear in trouble political times, being in the middle of a climate and ecological emergency, witnessing terrible things, war, injustice, suffering, and quite a few of the check-ins that I've been in lately, there's been people who saying, you know, it's just all of this stuff going on, but particularly the Middle East and particularly Gaza is just weighing very, very heavily. So hopefully we'll have plenty of time to discuss this evening. But I'll just kind of lay a few things out here. So practice does not change our situation, but it puts us in the best possible position to remain strong, to meet circumstances to the best of our ability, to maintain some degree of stability, if not equanimity. Practice can help us hold on to a sense of hope or determination or purpose. And it can help us take bold action when appropriate. I think sometimes, maybe even without realizing it, some of us hope that practice, or at least, you know, Zen Buddhism or something kind of can give us some answers or some tools for fixing things, you know, like how can it have better relationships? You know, what does Zen say about how we should run the world so there can be fewer conflicts and less injustice and all of that kind of stuff? But, and it can seem sometimes then, you know, when the answer is like, well, this just helps us be the best people we can be, it can seem like a little bit of a cop-out in a way. Maybe like we're just focusing on ourselves and, you know, whatever happens in the rest of the world happens. But it really is significant and important. Really is valuable for us to be in as good a spot as we can be, to be as clear as we can be, to have as much perspective as possible, to have some emotional regulation, what have you. So I just came up with a short list of ways that I see practice as being beneficial for when life is tough. And if anybody else, if other things occur to you, please jump in afterwards and share how practice has been helpful to you in tough times. One thing that I think is extremely important is the habit of practice. So when our life starts fraying at the edges, we just have the habit of sitting zazen. We just have the habit of connecting with sangha. We have it ingrained and we keep doing it, even when maybe momentarily we don't really see why, or, you know, it might even be difficult to get ourselves to do it, but we've just started to do it. And all of these things, I guess, kind of like, you know, exercise and eating well and all that, all of these things are healthy habits which will help us remain as healthy and stable as we can be. And that's where some of the forms and rituals of our practice are, they can end up be, the value of them sometimes will appear most when things are starting to fray around the edges. You know, when things are going well, maybe it doesn't seem that important. Oh, we chant the Heart Sutra, you know, we bow to our meditation cushion, you know, we light a candle at the altar or something, but then, you know, when you're lying in a hospital bed and your Sangha members come and you chant the Heart Sutra together, that's pretty cool. When, you know, somebody, you know, something's going on and you go to, you know, light a stick of incense at your altar and kind of hold a prayer for them in your heart, or these kinds of things end up, you realize how important they are. They're in your body. Then on a very different note, there's the practicing the perfection of Kshanti, which is there's six perfections in Mahayana Buddhism. So generosity, morality, energy, or you know, vigor, zeal, meditation or concentration, and wisdom. And I don't know how many that is, but anyway, one of them. And then Kshanti. Does that day get six then? All right. So then, which is patience or tolerance or forbearance. And I think it's so, to me, what Kshanti means is then our practice is acknowledging that no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you practice, things are going to suck sometimes. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that acknowledgement that, you know, even if, oh, you have awakened to the emptiness of self and you know, you live with gratitude and equanimity, whatever, there's going to be something that breaks your heart, right? And it's going to hurt and it's going to be terrible and it's going to suck. And it just needs to be endured. So this is, they also can be translated as endurance. But it's not a resigned, it's not resignation, but it's like, it's remaining strong even during difficult times. Not being broken, forbearing. An unglamorous perfection, right? You can think of a lot of people saying like, yes, I want to, you know, practice the paramita of generosity. I want to practice the paramita of meditation. I want to practice the paramita of wisdom. Nobody says, I really want to practice the paramita of patience and forbearance. Like nobody really wants to do that. But sometimes that's what it is. And I think that's a real beauty to dignifying that as a perfection, to say this is real practice, simply in at this moment, things are so difficult, simply enduring. And not like, I mean, maybe you do freak out, whatever, but simply enduring and not just giving up or running away or whatever is a spiritual practice, is a valuable spiritual practice. So we had the habit of practice, the perfection of Kshanti, I think non-opposition to one's own reactions is a valuable thing that our practice gives us. You know, when we sit in Zazen and we allow thoughts and feelings to arise, we allow them to pass. We kind of acknowledge them sometimes. I don't know about you, but sometimes I may not even realize how I'm feeling until I sit and then I go, I see. So non-opposition to those feelings helps them move through in a healthy way. So even something like anger, which we might try to stop, try to stifle, try to get over, try to let go of or something, but to really recognize that, you know, anger is, we've perceived that something needs to be protected. It may or may not be the case. Maybe an open question as to how or if that anger should be expressed or manifest, but that is our experience. Our experience right now is that something is threatened. All right, and then the anger arises. Grief, I have couple podcast episodes about grief. Grief is like losing part of ourselves. And that just is going to hurt for quite a while, and we will never be the same. And in a way, that's there's a way our practice can help us embrace those things without being completely overwhelmed by them, at least not permanently. And then there's seeing our stories for what they are. So we do this in our zazen, we do this in our practice, in our karma work, recognizing our narratives. And recognizing our narratives are not the same thing as reality. They may have some aspects of truth to them. But one of the big stories that we tell ourselves is it should not be this way. And now, well, that's a very understandable story. We don't have to, like, non-opposition to one's own reactions also means recognizing, okay, I'm thinking it should not be this way. You know, we don't have to beat ourselves up for thinking that. But it also is not a helpful thing. And by this, I mean, we separate out what has come up to this point and what is going to happen in the future. So this has nothing to do with what's going to happen in the future and maybe how we should respond, how we should try to change things, speak up for ourselves, anything like that. All of that may need to happen. But we're talking about, you know, sometimes our narrative is about it shouldn't have ended up like this. It shouldn't. It, up until now, this situation. And this is a tricky one. I mean, to a certain extent, we could say there should not be war. But what we're really expressing there, I think, is we wish there wasn't war. It would be a wonderful thing if there was no war. And that's completely, like, there's no problem with that part, right? Wish there was no war. War is a terrible thing. I want to see war end. But the story that there should not be, I always think, like, who ever gave us, like, we did not get any guarantees about this life, about this world. There were no promises. Like, we are on an arc toward justice, and it's going to just be a straight arc, and it's only going to get better from here. I mean, nobody ever said that. I think one of my favorite kind of encouraging things was just, like, you know, sometimes when you look at humankind and you just think, oh, Lord, what are we doing to ourselves? How did this happen? Oh, my goodness. And somebody put it like, we just crawled out of the forest on all fours. Like, we have, if you look at the time scale of the earth, we have not. Civilization has not been around very long at all. I don't know. That kind of cheers me up sometimes to think about that. So we have those stories. We have stories about blame, blaming others, often blaming ourselves. Or why me? Why did this happen to me? Looking for some reason why did I deserve this somehow? And somehow I think we almost prefer to think that we deserved it, that we earned it somehow, because it gives us a sense of control. Like, it was something we did that caused this, as opposed to, like, having to accept something could just be horribly, horribly random and terrible. And the practice helps us see these stories for what they are, not, I think it's important not to reject these thoughts, or imagine that somehow we can just cut these stories out of our brain. But recognizing in what sense they are narratives. And this isn't just an intellectual thing. This is something that we touch in our zazen. This is something where we learn how to settle, even if for moments, into another way of being, into a physical, embodied, just this moment way of being. And we recognize how narratives are always an inaccurate portrayal, a gloss, when describing this reality. So they can end up not being quite as compelling. We're not necessarily quite 100% believing our narratives. We can be like, yeah, that is just a story I'm telling myself. And then I thought about how we can use loss and difficulty to turn up the heat on our practice, to face impermanence, to face no self, to face mortality head on, to take up that challenge of seeing our life as precious no matter what. Like my husband said, Zen practice is for tough times. This, and to some extent, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just weird and other people could speak up, but when I got into Zen, I don't know, I was, I don't really get depressed. I get despairing. And so life just seemed quite pointless and bleak. And just the thought of, you know, all the stuff going on in the world and how ephemeral everything is just made me think, like, what's kind of the point? But then when I got into practice, what I recognized was I had this, now this kind of sense of purpose and direction, which would apply no matter what happened, no matter what happened in my life. If the worst case scenario happened, I could practice. I will always have this. No matter what, I will always have this. And that was like, that is very, very consoling, right? If all the people in my life deserted me, I would have practice. If I lost all my physical faculties, I would have practice. If I lost all my mental faculties, to some extent, I could still have practice. It would look different, but. So, all of the things that we think of when, you know, life is difficult are opportunities from a Zen practice point of view. They are about shaking up our sense of who we are. They're about loss that we're having to face impermanence. They're about a wildly shifting sense of self, a shifting sense of the world, which really encourages us to look below the level of our narratives about ourselves to a deeper truth. And again, that's not that we have no self, but that our self has no fixed nature and that it's dependently co-arisen with everything around us. And so when we experience loss and grief and change, we're experiencing that firsthand, how it's not just my little self over here. It's like part of me was in that job. Part of me was in that person. Part of me is in the health of our natural systems. Part of me is in the people in the Middle East. And so I experience all of that. So the, it may be painful, but it also is teaching me about like the boundlessness of self. So it's not that we want loss or difficulty, but at least when you are visited by loss and difficulty, you know, it's the time is ripe for really challenging practice and potentially very fruitful practice. So I will once again, just I'm going to read the little bullet points that I put at the end of this chapter and then open it up. So there are no circumstances in which Zen practice does not apply. There are conditions where it is extremely challenging to practice, but if you do, the rewards are great. So when we think about really challenging situations, when I imagine myself being in Gaza, I think, well, you know, what would Zen practice look like there? I mean, I'd probably be of a different religion if I was there, but let's just say the form of our practice might be different. The form meaning the things that we can see, the things that we do. So maybe at a certain point, we won't be able to sit Zazen anymore, and we're going to have to be lying down in a bed and trying to do Zazen. Maybe we won't be able to visit the Sangha, or maybe we won't be able to bow, or maybe we won't be able to chant, or maybe we won't be able to read, or maybe whatever. But those are just forms that our practice takes. The practice can take other forms, which are adaptable. And the practice is really the attitude that we are taking each moment. So we can always practice. And Zen practice gives you a greater ability to change the way you think about things. And this can make all the difference when it comes to facing adversity. Forbearance or attentive endurance is considered a Buddhist perfection. It acknowledges that sometimes life is difficult and painful, but allows a calm, dignity, and gratitude in the midst of hardship. And extremely distressing experiences like physical illness and pain, or the loss of something or someone important to you, are profound opportunities for learning. They require you to let go of all kinds of attachments and directly challenge your delusion of inherent enduring self-nature. So with that, open it up. Comments or questions? Shinryu.
So thank you so much for this talk, very much. I found myself nodding my head a lot. I fully believe the last things you were sharing, and now I can't even use your own words, but this is not why I practice, but the fact that my continuous practice prepares me in some way for when the going gets really tough. I believe that, and I feel like I know that. But the problem is I haven't practiced long enough to where that is not quite as automatic as I would like for it to be, but I'm closer than I used to be. But, you know, we're talking about when times get really tough, and I do not mean to make light of this at all, because Lord knows times are pretty awful. Pretty awful. But I have a practice I maintain. I have regular meditation. I have connections in the Sangha. I maintain those. And yet when my husband and I go on vacation, it's all gone. I cannot even meditate. I've tried it. I've gotten to the point where it is just so much easier for me to give it up. 5 days here, I'm not going to do anything. And then when I get back home, pick it up again. And I cannot explain that kind of silly phenomenon. But on the other hand, I believe if I were put in some very, very difficult situation, I would be able to maintain my practice in some way. Go figure.
Well, I kind of had, you know, there's no motivator like pain. You know, and I was having problems with my shoulder, went to the physical therapist. He gave me the exercises. I did the exercises. I got over it. Like, yeah, like, you know, and now that it's not so bad, it's kind of like, well, you know, I should do those exercises. But I mean, there's no motivator like pain. So sometimes essentially we're kind of in a heaven realm, right? We're just like, what problems? And then, you know, I think that's, it's okay to just enjoy those times. But that's where, when we're kind of the in-between, this is where like the teaching of the six realms is kind of useful as a metaphor. So in the Buddhist cosmology, which you don't have to literally believe, but there's six realms, not just heaven and hell. You don't stay in heaven or hell. You transmigrate through them in various lives. And you're reborn in a very realm based on what your previous actions. So in heaven, everything's so nice, everybody forgets to practice until their karma runs out, and then they're reborn in a different realm. And then in hell, it's just so, it's so miserable. So miserable, basically because beings have said yes to hatred. So it's not kind of a externally imposed thing, but it's very, very difficult to practice. The beast realm, the beasts are all just, they just want to eat, sleep, and have sex, and, you know, they can't be bothered with practice. And then the hungry ghosts are, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places. And the fighting demons used to be gods, and they can see the gods, and they're really jealous of the gods. So, but the human realm is kind of like a mix of both, right? It's not too nice. It's not too painful. It's the ideal realm to practice in. So this is where, like, hopefully most of us are more or less in the human realm. And so it can be kind of hard to motivate ourselves to practice sometimes, but we're not so miserable that we can't practice. So we try to do it because we're a little bit more motivated than those in the heaven realm. I think Eric was next.
So I kind of, when you were speaking about, you know, we'll always have our practice, that really resonated. But I've had probably the hardest year of my personal life. And I was actually, it came to a head in September, and I was listening to the Zen Studies podcast, and you were doing, I think you actually, the one I listened to was actually the one on, one of the ones on the six different realms. And I, for some reason, I don't know why, I think it is because hard times, you know, pain makes it click. But all of a sudden I realized what practice really meant and how it was a everyday living opportunity. And so it's like, once that happened and I began to see practice in that way, and that everything I was doing to make it was practice. It was practicing to get it right, practicing to do it in a better way. And then from your instruction in a Zen way, it has really changed the way I approach not only problems, but life in general. And it's almost like I have like different, I mean, I'm old enough to remember cassette tapes. And it's almost like I have different cassette tapes that I kind of plug in. Like, okay, it's time for this practice now to get through this situation or to get to this or whatever else. So that's kind of not only what this has meant to me and what this has done for me, but how I kind of view it going forward with the whole practice and everything. And I've really grown to cherish practice as the walking stick on the journey, rather than looking for some sort of solution that may or may not present itself.
Well put. Thank you. Coral.
Can you hear me? Sorry, I'm on my phone. I'm not used to. Okay, yeah. Great. I can even actually turn on my camera for this question. This is a big motivator for my practice. And I guess this is an observation, but it's also kind of a question, because I'm wondering if it can be taken too far. I'm really hard on myself, to the point where, like, even if I get a cold, I'm like in misery. Like, I just like can't even handle it. I'm so dramatic. I got myself sick, or, you know, like, I don't know if you guys remember, I failed the PE exam, the professional engineering exam, and I just like harped on it for like a year. I just couldn't understand, like, and these are just like tiny little inconveniences. So you can imagine when something really big happens, I am just like flat out non-functioning. And practice has really done a lot for me in that way. Just like sitting with the discomfort of being like, okay, I'm sick, or, you know, that didn't work out for me this time, maybe next time. But something that's been on my mind a lot lately is my grandma she recently went into memory care, and my great grandma also had dementia. And throughout her life, she was kind of nasty. I mean, she was a difficult person to be around when she was fully like herself. And in dementia, with the dementia, she is really miserable and unhappy. And it freaks me out. It really scares me. And I frequently think that, you know, if I practice enough and I make it a part of who I am and my core, no matter what happens to me, I can find joy and I can live with joy. But the root of that is fear. And I feel like I'm grasping. And I'm wondering if this is like, if I've taken it past like a healthy motivation for practice.
I don't know. I mean, probably only you know, you know, yeah, what it's doing to your mind. But I mean, I'll confess that that's a little, anyways, I guess it's not secret, but it's a little hope that I hold. Like, I don't have a lot of hope for it, but I do hope that I can practice as sincerely and deeply as possible, and that if I get dementia, I will be like a nice person with dementia, you know? Like,
yeah.
And we don't know. We don't. And that's like, I feel like when you consider practicing with that awareness of what dementia might do to you, you know, like really exposing the unresolved karma, right? Like, and so I'm a little worried that I'm going to be one of the people who's just like absolutely convinced they have to go to work. You know, I was wandering around the nursing home, just like, I gotta be somewhere. And everybody just be like, you don't have to go anywhere. I'm like, no, I've got to do something. Like, I'm a little worried that I'll be like that, but hopefully maybe at another level, like I'll be okay with that. Maybe I'll cheerfully be trying to get projects done in a nursing home. I don't know. But I just, my example was like, you know, because there are some people who are just so miserable, and not that we should blame somebody who ends up, you know, who knows what happens, maybe how we've lived doesn't have anything to do with it, but it kind of looks like it has something to do with it. But I was coming in out of a memory care unit, and this woman looked at me, she's like, dear, can you tell me what year it is?
Oh. And it was just so sweet. And I was like, I told her what year. Well, thank you.
Ah, if only I could make that much peace with just like, and I do think, I mean, I gotta hope, you know, if we're getting used to kind of letting go, right? Kind of getting a growing familiarity and comfort with impermanence and with recognizing kind of a boundless nature of self, it makes sense that we wouldn't be so terrified when we start to see these things shift and change. That will just be like, Judith.
Well, on a lighter note about dementia. My mother was demented, and she told, so she's in Wenatchee, Washington, in a very nice place, and the staff, it turns out, well, we lost her. We didn't know where she was for quite a while. And then we found her, and she was in this nice nursing home. And so it turns out that the staff are very interested in her because she has told them, they know that she came from Alaska. She told them that she was one of the few women who had won the Iditarod. And there were a number of situations like that.
Was she?
Well, that was exactly what the staff wanted to know. And I started laughing. I said, no, but then she had lived in Alaska long enough to know the names of some of the women who had won the Iditarod. So she has this amazing story going. Well, they took me over to the nurse's desk and they had a list of delusional things that she had told them. That she was having an affair with Franklin Delano Roosevelt with his wife's permission. And that she had had one. So, you know, it was okay. Well, anyway, the staff adored her. Now, I, as an RN, have seen people in the ER, John Doe's, who come in and nicely dressed, the cops have picked him up. They're wandering through the ER asking us over and over again, what year is this? Where am I? And that's hard to take. But I guess what I'm trying to reassure you is there are multiple ways, as you were saying, that people can present their dementia, and that some of them, my mother got the best treatment because of her delusional stories. They loved her. Anyway, I hope I have them myself. I'm counting on it, right?
Thank you.
Tyler.
Yeah, I guess I've been just reflecting on some of the things you've been talking about, and I am hoping, you know, as the longer I do this, and I'm finding more times when, yeah, I really like, I look when my practice is really sustaining me through hard times, or you know, when I just, your discussion about how if you were in Gaza right now, and it's funny because I've been reflecting on it lately, you know, that the Sunni Muslims pray multiple times a day, and how that might be completely disrupted in their situation, but also how being able to, like, having that that, as you said, that routine or pattern in there to like to stop and take that moment and pray or meditate or whatever you're doing and convene in any way that you're doing could be like what sustains you through that. Mm-hmm. And I've never had a practice previous in my life or prayed or anything like that, but building that is just reflecting on what that might, you know, hopefully, obviously I'll probably never experience anything like that. Of course, hopefully none of us do, but just knowing that, yeah, building that practice for when things get hard and just being able to rely on it as a, without having to like put work into it, but it's just something, yeah, that you just do to get you through, just seems like a really beautiful and important thing. So thank you for bringing that up.
And I think it's valuable to, when I said like you can always practice and fundamentally the practice remains the same, even if the forms change, fundamentally the practice remains the same, which, you know, there's many teachings, you know, recognizing dukkha, trying to let go of our attachment to self, you know, keeping the precepts, these kinds of things. I think it's easy, but I think it's natural sometimes when our life falls apart to think I can't practice right now. I don't have time for that stuff. I don't have the energy for that stuff or whatever. Just somehow we might think of like Zen practice as a hobby or a pastime or like an extra thing that we do that we kind of add to our life. And then, you know, when it becomes really stressful, then, you know, that has to go. Some things have to go. But, you know, I'm too stressed. I have to worry too much about money. I have to work too much. I'm in too much pain, da, 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 da. Now, all of those things can make practice much, much more challenging. But the practice remains the same. It remains exactly the same. And I think this is valuable to remember for our own sakes when things go wrong, but also in terms of other people, not assuming someone can't practice or can't practice as deeply or something because of their circumstances, because they are a busy mom with several small kids, then they can't really, you know, their practice is compromised, or because, you know, they have chronic pain, because they are stuck at home with RA or something, then they can't really practice. It's like the form may be different and it may be more difficult in certain circumstances, certain ways, but the practice remains the same. So I don't know. I find that daunting, but encouraging, you know, because like I said, I will always have my practice. Well, that seems like a good place to stop. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout the faith and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parinata. Thank you for coming, everyone.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.